Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, environmental activism in the age of Trump. Yes, the president has pulled out of Paris. He's put an EPA chief in office who doesn't believe in the science of climate change. But the president is also a capitalist who has promised to create jobs. And jobs are growing quickly in the renewable energy sector. And his decision on Paris galvanized states and cities to declare they will meet the Paris Accord standards. So what does it mean to be an environmental activist in an age of urgency and inertia? Three roundtablers, your thoughts via social media as well. If you vote on, volunteer, or work professionally in the environmental activist field, do you see bleak times ahead under the Trump administration? Or have you encountered some unexpected opportunity? I want to hear from you on Twitter about that. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guests on the roundtable, Terry Tempest Williams is a writer and environmental advocate. Her newest book, now out in paperback, is titled The Hour of the Land. You can find my interview with Terry on my podcast. She is in person on the roundtable. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Nicole Rahm is with us, Executive Director for Climate Generation, a Will Steger legacy. Nicole, so glad you could make it.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And Mitch Hedlund is with us, Executive Director for Recycle Across America. And Mitch, welcome. Really good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Terry, I'm using the phrase environmental activism, but you know, as I thought about that, I thought that kind of feels too narrow for how wide-ranging this conversation can be and should be. So this encompasses social justice and equity and ethics and all of the things that you think about. Where are you on that in this first 6 months of this new administration?
I think you've touched on absolutely the heart of where I'm thinking, as you always do, Carrie. What would happen if we took away the label, the title, I'm going to say the stigma of activist, and instead replaced it with citizen, engaged citizen? I find, coming from Utah, that the minute you say activist, you lose your credibility. You're angry. You're full of rage. You're a disruptor. So I'm trying to get rid of that label, because I think part of a working, thriving, replenished democracy, it's not about being an activist. It's about being an engaged citizen, rooted in community.
Why can't we reclaim the word activist? I hear you loud and clear on that, because then people just kind of stop listening. Is that the concern, Nicole?
Yes, absolutely. I think people immediately think, oh, I must march in the streets. And that's not always for everyone. In Terry's book, The Hour of Land, she has this really powerful quote where she says, to bear witness is not a passive act.
Yes.
It's an act of conscience and consequence. And I think about that statement, to bear witness is not a passive act, when I look at my work and our organization's founding from Will Steger's powerful eyewitness account and 50 years of exploration and being motivated and mobilized out of his concern for what's happening in the polar regions, and realizing that to be an eyewitness, to witness the changes that you're seeing and sharing that through your powerful personal experience can really mobilize action. And so I love the metaphor and the reframing of engaged citizenry. I think that's exactly how you can invite a wide range community to get engaged. And we need everyone engaged. We're seeing an assault on so many issues and areas that we care about. And what better way to inspire people to join you is to remind them of their civic responsibility.
Mitch, when Terry came in, she used the word rage and said she'd been experiencing some of that. And I'm going to come back to her on that. Did you too? I mean, have you had to find a place to put the, well, some of the natural despair and anger?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I in a way, I feel like I still haven't woken up from this kind of strange reality that we're in now. And it is trying to figure out, how do we cope with this, and how do we take action with that rage and with that really almost non-reality. It seems like we can't, it seems very difficult for a lot of us who are sure that this couldn't happen to wake up and see that it did happen. And now what do we do when things are changing so quickly? And I think you also have to be able to really take that rage and turn it into something positive, because it can also really start to affect you. And, you know, we are three women and four women in this room that do take action. And if we are finding that that rage sometimes is nothing more than just rage, it can harm our ability to take action and to help hopefully motivate some other people to do some good with that.
Terry, is that the conclusion you kind of had to come to about your anger?
You know, with a name like Tempest, I have no hope. It's. I think for me, anger can be useful if it's channeled, like you were saying, Mitch. So I would add sacred rage. You know, how do we take our anger and, again, put it to use? We know what we sacrifice, but not at sacrificing our own values, our own sense of self, and what we stand for. So I'm really interested in sacred rage. How do we take that which we love and fight for it, honor it, embrace it in the name of other?
Nicole just jotted that down.
What
does that say to you?
Sacred rage. Well, I was thinking about how, for me, despair is a form of denialism. There's no room for despair. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the day after the election. I happened to run an organization of 10 people, including myself, 9 women, all ages from 22 to 54. And we had to hold a collective space that morning. I came to the office not knowing quite what I would find. And we just had to come together as a community and as an organization dedicating ourselves to the issue of addressing climate change, and hold space for tears, for anger, for shock. And over the course of probably an hour and a half together with my coworkers, it was magnificent to see our team go from such shock and anger and frustration and sadness and grief, a lot of grief, to motivation and to this collective consciousness that our mission stays the same, our work stays the same, we're just going to dig in deeper, and we're needed more now more than ever. People need us. And that was the message we decided to put out to our community that very day, this notion of radical hope. And so I think about sacred rage on one end and radical hope on the other, and we need both.
I mean, the other thing that's going on here, though, is even as I said, the president has appointed an EPA chief who doesn't believe in the science of climate change, and the president is all over the place on where he's at on climate change. I mean, in some ways, Mitch, this has galvanized people in a way that they might not have been galvanized if Hillary Clinton had won. I mean, this is why I use this line about what it means to be an environmental activist or an environmental citizen in an age of urgency and inertia. There was a lot of inertia, right?
Exactly.
Leading up to this.
I think that that's true. I think that, you know, I don't think that we want to consider ourselves as being passive in the last 30 years or complacent, but I think that there has been some of that. And I think, you know, how many times have we worked on projects where there's multiple people working in a team, which is great and healthy and welcome. But when you feel that maybe certain parts of the team are carrying the ball on it, you tend to relax a little bit more, thinking, okay, that's being covered. And I think what's happened in this is that team has been so disrupted and turned upside down that it's now becoming really evident that really we can't be complacent. We can't rely on the federal government to make the change. And CEOs of global organizations are coming to the position where they're being very candid. They're stepping out like never before. Mayors, governors, all sorts of leaders and individuals are stepping up where they might have felt that they were part of a team, but that the ball was really being carried by the leadership of this country. And now that they know that that's not the case, we all and they all are really carrying the ball forward and being much more proactive and outspoken about it. And something that I find is interesting as an example of this in our scope, recycling is really struggling in the U.S. To the point where somebody by the name of John Tierney wrote an article in the New York Times, and actually he wrote an article about 10 years ago, 20 years, about 10 years ago, in the New York Times called Recycling is Garbage. And when he wrote that article in the New York Times received more hate mail than any other article in the New York Times before it. So the thing is if we know that the public is passionate about this, you know, they're passionate about protecting the national parks, they're passionate about protecting the water, the outcry over Flint, Michigan's water situation, all of that is incredible, powerful, positive rage in a really effective way if we can start to put it in a direction where action can be had. Because rage is one thing, but action is the critical
part. So let me quibble with you a little bit. Are people passionate about it? Or when you bring it up in a poll and say, do you want the national parks? And I'm looking at you, Terry, because you wrote about this in your newest book. Do you want the national parks preserved for future generations? I think who would say no to that? But are they passionate and active?
I think they are. And I think national parks are a great proving ground for this. Over 1 million people have sent in comments to the Department of Interior saying, we want these 27 monuments that are under review not to be rescinded, not to be reduced, not to be questioned, but to remain protected. Over 1 million people. Mm-hmm. And yet still, Secretary Zinke, under the thumb of our president, and I would say the fossil fuel industry, are recommending a place like Bears Ears in southern Utah, directed, led by the tribes, reduced. They're not listening to the people. That warrants outrage to me, because that is a violation of our rights as citizens in the open space of democracy. You know, you look at Cumberland Island, just off the coast of Georgia. Local people who love that park, came together outraged, saying, no, we do not want you to sell these lands away. People in Wyoming, Yellowstone, Grand Teton, Glacier, are saying, no, it is not okay to delist the grizzly when we know it is vulnerable, to open it up for hunting. People, again, in the sagebrush flats in the interior west are saying, no, you cannot take away the protection of the sage grouse, who I think is the most important individual in the American West, because it's the only individual that is standing in the way of unlimited fossil fuel development. So I think people are passionate. I think they are responding. Our senators' phones are ringing off the wall. Mm-hmm. I just heard from Senator Tom Udall from New Mexico. Mm-hmm. He said prior to the election, they were getting 50 calls a day. Now they're getting between 500 and 1,000 calls a day. That matters. So people are responding, and I think our national parks are a rallying cry.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead,
I would
Nicole.
Say I'm seeing the same thing locally here in Minnesota, whether it's people, their love of places. So here in Minnesota, the Boundary Waters Canoeira Wilderness is and Lake Superior, they're both really sacred watersheds. We're seeing people come out in force with each public comment period. As we look at the potential for copper nickel mining in northeastern Minnesota, there's been an outpouring of support on that. After the election, we had several local businesses contact us saying, we're really concerned. We want to dig in and do something. We want to partner with you and educate our consumers. For example, this was a small local green dry cleaning business. And so we partnered with them for the whole month of April, where they educated all of their customers on the connection between green cleaning and climate change. And it was a great opportunity for us to, you know, connect locally. And we're seeing that galvanized support from public, from business at all scales, as well as from, as you mentioned, Mitch, from city government and from states. I was extremely proud to see Minnesota join The only state in the Midwest and the Heartland joined the West and East Coast, saying we're going to support the goals laid out in the Paris Climate Agreement. And that was thanks to both strong leadership, but public support, where elected officials know they have the support.
That's an interesting thing, because Governor Brown has announced a climate summit in San Francisco in September of 2018. Again, this idea that California has been leading the way on a lot of these things, but he's got the power to gather world leaders because of California's stature. Would he have done that? Probably not, if Hillary Clinton had ended up winning. So strides being made. Does this surprise you, Terry, in the midst of what looked like it was going to be 10 steps backward? Maybe it isn't.
It's hard for me to be positive.
Really?
I mean, I do think we're awake, and I think that's a good thing. But I just feel like what's at stake is so immense, and what's going to be very difficult to retrieve, all of the regulations that are just gone, that are going to be very difficult to get back because they will require acts of legislation. I don't think we have the will or the desire or the experience in Congress to bring those back.
No matter who's president.
I really don't. And I look at what happens with the grizzly or the sage grouse, if they are taken off the endangered species list, and they will be delisted. We're at a critical point. So I just think we have to really, each of us in our own way with the gifts that are ours, bear down and give birth to a new way of being in our communities and create these unexpected alliances that Mitch and Nicole are talking about. I have a question, being here in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. How are you all feeling about, you know, the money being pulled from the Great Lakes Restoration Project?
Yeah, that's been a big issue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that strikes me that that's not Republican or Democrat, not right or left, but absolutely central to a quality of life here in this region. What's happening there? What are you hearing?
We can say that Governor Dayton has mm-hmm. responded by making water quality one of his top priorities for the remainder of his term. But Nicole and Mitch?
I was going to say one piece is we're seeing philanthropy step up. Not that that's going to take the place of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and the tremendous amount of resources that was put into both stopping invasive species like the Asian carp to restoring coastline to public education. So one piece is philanthropy stepping up to fill in. And I do think your point around this is a rallying call for people across the region as a whole. We had tremendous international and state collaboration when that was set up, and I don't think it's going to just happen lightly.
Mitch, what would you say to that?
Well, I think it's interesting. There's a couple of things that are happening, some in societal behavior. I think people can take action and they can work with their mayors and they can work with their leaders and brand leaders and small business leaders. But I agree with Terry that there's that other category that is where societal behavior doesn't have an impact on some of these decisions. And the Great Lakes Restoration changes, I think, crosses both, because it's not a national park. It is residents. It is a community of the state that can take action and take over where leadership might have left a hole. But when it comes to the national parks and some things that are truly on a broader scale that society can't necessarily influence, I do think that we're at great risk of changes that can do great harm. But I think when it comes to Minnesota, you know, I think Minnesotans are good stock. I think that they step in really strong ways and unite. And I think that protecting these lakes that we have, our waterways that we have, including the Great Lakes, is something that is kind of top of mind for a lot of people that live in this state.
That's what I was thinking is, you know, something like the Bears Ears Monument in the national parks get a lot of attention and a lot of news coverage. The day-to-day quality of the water, and this is a state in an area that just should be fully invested in pristine water quality. Now that's the really hard stuff too, yeah. Because it is just gradual legislation and gradual management of all the competing interests. I think mm-hmm. that may be even more difficult than...
And that's the daily work.
Right, yeah. Right.
And, you know, I love the idea, you know, we always think there's going to be a savior, a new leader bow to. I don't believe that.
Right.
I think the new leader is community. And it's doing the daily work, the hard work, every single day, showing up at meetings, organizing. That is what is required now.
Yeah.
And that really is what a democracy is. And I think that, again, each of us in our communities, the place we call home, if we recommit to what that quality of life looks like, water, air, wildlife, mm-hmm. fellowship with other species, including our own, then we do have a view for the long term. And Trump is Trump, and he will be gone. But our communities won't be.
You sound more hopeful than you just said you were.
You know? I've taken hope out of my vocabulary, Carrie, because I think hope is attached to my desires. I have enormous faith, and I believe in faith. And my great-grandmother always said, faith without works is dead. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I come from a Mormon, again, good stock, and it's put your shoulder to the wheel. I'm not going to leave much to hope. I care too much.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable, and we've gathered a group of women in the NPR studio here to talk about what it means to be, I started this out saying, environmental activist. Our guests on the roundtable would prefer the word citizen, so we'll go with that from now. What it means to be an environmental citizen, an engaged citizen on the environment in an age where there are some significant changes happening to environmental legislation, also to leadership on the idea of climate change. I mean, what is it to be an environmental engaged citizen in the age of Donald Trump? I opened the conversation saying there has been a lot of inertia. There has also been urgency. So we have to take that into account. There's also job creation going on in the renewable energy sector. So how does that figure into our conversation? Terry Tempest Williams on the roundtable today. She's a writer, and her newest book is titled The Hour of the Land. Mitch Hedlund, Executive Director for Recycle Across America. Nicole Rahm, Executive Director for Climate Generation, a Will Steger legacy. And I want to say that I would love to hear from you. If you vote on, you volunteer, you work professionally in the environmental field, do you see bleak times ahead under the Trump administration? Or, and we've talked about this a little bit, are you encountering some unexpected opportunity? You can tell me either way on Twitter. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. I wanted to ask you all, I think the reason that you, as you acknowledge this, Terry and Mitch and Nicole did too, is activist carries a pretty heavy burden with it. Is the image, though, of who the activist is changing? I mean, can the activist wear a business suit and work in a corner office just as easily today as the person that we would traditionally think of as an environmental activist? Mitch, you say yeah.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think, you know, we're missing a really powerful ingredient that exists today as all these changes are taking place. Social media has the ability to be, well, as we've seen, topple governments, right? Mm-hmm. You know, way back when I was 19 years old, I worked at Dayton's at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And just a quick example of how things have changed because of social media and technology. At that time, Dayton's had made a contribution to United Way years and years ago, and United Way being tied to Planned Parenthood. There were a lot of customers who had sent in their credit cards, clipped them, and sent them in with a letter discounting, you know, Dayton's position on that.
Really?
And maybe there were 250 people that had come together and taken that effort and said, I'll never shop at Dayton's again. Fast forward now, and I can't remember the year, but where the governor that was up for, or candidate for governor was up for election, who was anti-gay marriage. And the CEO of Target Corporation, right. Do you remember
yes.
this?
Yes.
Had made a major contribution.
This is during the referendum.
Right.
Right.
And within an hour, there were 500,000 signatures through social media saying people will not shop at Target anymore. Mm-hmm. And instantly he was ousted and had to resign, and the board took a position on all of this. And it was an instant reaction. At the time that I worked for Dayton's, and people were, you know, so upset about this donation to Planned Parenthood, only 250 people took the effort to actually send in their cards. And there was a form letter that came from the CEO taking a stake in their position of why they did what they did, but there was no change. Social media has the instant, within seconds, ability to make everybody an activist. And that power, when it's organized in the right way, mm-hmm. can change systems instantly.
It's also easy, though, to tweet out sign me up on that petition, right? And now I feel good, and that's all I have to do.
Right. And this is the other part, is we also have to get past the petition. We have to get to the point where companies feel a true burden. Uh-huh. And I think that the greatest power that topples the negative use of social media with our leadership right now, which is what he's using, right, is the ability to say, we are consumers, we are the majority that believe in protecting things for the life of our children, ourselves, and we understand how interconnected we are. We have dollars in our pockets, we have opinions, we don't need to march today, we need to put pressure on corporate leaders, because if they want our money, then they need to respond to the masses' activism, basically, to protect these things. And I think we need to get really organized in using that form of consumerism partnered with social media, and in a way reverse the use of Citizens United in an opposite way from where it is right now.
How would you do that, Nicole? That's interesting.
Well, I was just thinking about this notion of an activist comes in all shapes and sizes. We do a lot of work with teachers and young people. And I think about, you know, a teacher is very much, as they're educating their students on the world that they're going to enter and the jobs of the future, it's their responsibility to be educating their students on issues like climate change and the opportunity. We think about citizen scientists and the average person who's contributing to monitoring bees in their backyard, or changes from climate change and how certain plants are blooming earlier or later based on the changes in our season. I think about, for sure, the corporate citizen. And Mitch, we're absolutely seeing more and more of our consumer-facing companies doing the right thing. One of the most positive pieces of the Paris Climate Agreement 2 years ago was the role that the business community played in propelling that action forward. And I was extremely proud seeing so many of Minnesota's large mm-hmm. companies out there in front, including Best Buy and General Mills and several others that are headquartered here. I also know that several people are starting to actually march in the streets in ways that they never have. In fact, I believe that the Women's March had several women that have never, ever marched in their lives, brought their families, their kids. So we're seeing people also feeling called to actually march in the streets and go beyond calling their elected official. But I think it's always important to remember that we have a responsibility through our choices, through our dollars, through our voting. Those all have an impact, and we need to be using all of those tools in the toolbox.
Terry, Mitch said getting companies to feel the burden of this responsibility, right? How do you see that happening in a way that, I won't use the word hope, but gives you some measure of optimism? Or what is the way to require companies to do more of that?
I think about Utah, and I think about companies like Patagonia and Black Diamond and the outdoor industry, $60 million worth, especially in Utah, where they've held their outdoor industry conference.
Retailer show.
Yeah. The retailers, right. They had tremendous courage, and they called on our governor, who was not supporting the national monuments or Bears Ears or public lands, and they ultimately pulled out. The governor said, bravo, we don't need you. So I think, what lesson do we learn from that? I think we learned that courage is required, that we may not see immediate results. But my friend Ali from Iran just told me this beautiful quote from his father, who said we need to be patient because even eggs will walk. And I had to think about that. But
that's pretty good.
You know, if we're talking about sacred rage, let's talk about revolutionary patience. Patagonia has been one of those companies that has shown courage. The CEO just came out in support of Bears Ears and the monuments. She now has a bodyguard and received death threats. That's courage. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what the outcome is going to be. But again, it's right action in the face of tremendous pressure and support right now not to do the right thing. So, you know, the outdoor industry, retailers, convention or conference is not going to be in Utah. Our governor doesn't care. He is not accountable. But I think it's going to affect elections. He's not up for a re-election, but the next person will be. So again, I think we have to take the long view and the short view, and it's this, that, and all of it. And it's complicated. But again, for me, it just comes down to what are our own individual acts of courage. And there may be consequences, but that's where I absolutely support what you're saying in that in dark times, light appears, mm-hmm. and you follow that crack of light. And we don't know what the outcome is. All we can know is how we're going to each of us respond in the moment at hand.
I just find it extraordinary that we're, and maybe I shouldn't, that we're in a landscape where it takes an extraordinary act of courage to come out as the CEO of a company and take a stand on something.
On public lands.
My gosh.
Which are our birthright as Americans.
I mean, wow.
You know? That's where we are, and I think we have to be honest about it. You know, last night at Women and Children First in Chicago, a young woman...
It's a great bookstore, by the way.
Yeah. Isn't it? And I was saying to Mitch, this young woman who grew up in Florida near the Everglades, spent the last 3 months volunteering, she said, you know, the Everglades have had two seasons always, dry season, wet season. Now we only have wet season. They're flooding. Mm-hmm. And she became really emotional and she said, you know, tell me, how am I to prepare for the grief knowing that Dry Tortuga and mm-hmm. Everglades will be underwater?
Tell me, how
do I embrace this grief? You know, we all just sat in silence. And I said to her, honestly, I don't know. We have not been here before. But I think it has something to do with love and courage and not averting our gaze. Not mm-hmm. looking away, mm-hmm. but standing knee-deep in that water, even in the sawgrass. I don't know, but I think grief shows us where our love lies, mm-hmm. and we lose nothing by loving. That's where I believe we are.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. Terry Tempest Williams with us, Nicole Rahm, and Mitch Hedlund. We're talking about what it means to be an environmental citizen in this age of a lot of tumult and upheaval around environmental activism and environmental regulations, and in the age of President Trump's administration. We'll get a look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. President Trump is on his way back to the U.S. aboard Air Force One after a trip to France. Trump thanked French President Emmanuel Macron for hosting him in Paris for the annual Bastille Day celebrations. On Twitter, Trump says the two had great conversations on trade, the military, and security. Trump was the guest of honor at a parade that featured units of U.S. soldiers. A Russian-American lobbyist says he attended a June 2016 meeting with President Donald Trump's son, marking another shift in the account of a discussion that was billed as part of a Russian government effort to help the Republicans' White House campaign. Rinat Akhmetshin confirmed his participation to the Associated Press today. The meeting has heightened questions about whether Trump's campaign coordinated with the Russian government during the election, which is the focus of federal and congressional investigations. A federal judge has extended the list of family relationships with American citizens visa applicants can use to get into the U.S. The judge in Hawaii ruled the government cannot enforce the travel ban on grandparents, grandchildren, certain in-laws, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and cousins of people in the U.S. The ruling further weakens President Trump's visa policies affecting citizens from six Muslim-majority countries. And former President Jimmy Carter was back at a Habitat for Humanity worksite this morning, a day after he was hospitalized for dehydration while working with the organization to build homes for needy families in Canada. A smiling Carter showed up in blue jeans and a work shirt today to the site in the St. James neighborhood of Winnipeg, where hundreds of Habitat for Humanity volunteers joined the former president and his wife to build 25 homes. Jimmy Carter is 92 years old. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:41.
Garrison Keillor returns to the Minnesota State Fair Grandstand with a special broadcast performance of The Minnesota Show on Friday, September 1st at 7:45 p.m. Tickets and additional information can be found at prairiehome.org.
I'm Tom Weber. Stick with NPR News this morning. The Summer Music Series continues, coming up at 11. Andrea Swenson from The Current and I are interviewing Minnesota musicians every Friday during July and August. Today, you'll hear from Raina Del Cid. Join us.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the University of St. Thomas, where students are challenged to create daring solutions that shake up the status quo, all for the common good. More at stthomas.edu/commongood.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtable to consider what being an environmental citizen activist means in the age of the Trump administration, with renewed questions from the president about his belief in the science of climate change, with what's happening at the EPA, and with the withdrawal of the Paris Accords, but also knowing that there are people deeply committed to environmental change and the Paris Accords and new regulations and preservation and conservation who have stepped up. And so we're talking about, in the midst of all of that, what does it mean to be an environmental citizen? Mitch Hedlund with us from Recycle Across America. Nicole Rahm, Executive Director for Climate Generation. And Terry Tempest Williams is a writer and out with a new book called The Hour of the Land. Mitch, interesting thoughts here in the quick break that we took. You look around and say, confusion and chaos is, of course, detrimental to the kind of change that you're all invested in. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, I also heard you saying this doesn't have to obscure the capability that individuals have to do stuff that matters and to hold companies and themselves accountable. Have I paraphrased that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, if you look through history and even playbooks of war, chaos is a strategy, and it's a way to keep people in power by creating discord and dissension among the ranks, that type of. And I think we're there. I think that we're bumping into each other. We all feel the anger, we feel the rage, and people want to do something. But if it's not organized and if there isn't a way to actually take action, then it's very difficult to actually see results. And I think this is a remarkable opportunity to change that, especially with the era of social media, which allows consumers to have more power now than ever. I think all the ingredients are in society's hands to make change, even from the least passionate and the least active to the most motivated. And, we talked about this in the break, that 80-20 rule. Often you'll find in a company, maybe even in a family, whatever it is, that there's 20% of the people that will do 80% of the work. And I think that's all that it takes if they have a really great way to take action and get out of the chaos. And there are some solutions out there that can make that happen.
I want to see how Terry feels about the 80-20 rule. Is it enough?
I was terrible at math. So I'm just going to trust you, Mitch. We're talking about power. And for me, power always resides in the land. And, how do we sustain ourselves? And for me, it is the joy, the absolute sustaining joy and grace of spending time in the land, in wild places, in our own garden, wherever it is where the power of the earth seeps through our feet into our hands, into our minds, into our hearts. And I think that idea that beauty is its own form of resistance is a really powerful one as well. That we can't always be in our minds or always be in the space of politics that will ruin us. But if we can be in those places that inspire and ground us, then we can be part of that 20%, and it expands. May I share a story?
Yeah, the power of the individual is what I was just thinking.
I think about last year in Yosemite National Park, which really was our first national park. It was created by Abraham Lincoln after the worst year of the Civil War. He would never see Yosemite Valley or the Mariposa Grove where the big trees are, but he had the belief that this would bring a divided nation together. We're still a divided nation. What does one person mean, matter, make a difference? There was a woman I met who was a botanist, who is a botanist, and a ranger in Yosemite. Every day she would walk through the Mariposa Grove, and whether she knew it or not, she was listening to those trees. One day in her walk with these 2,000-year-old trees around her, she heard something, and it was distress. And she looked around, and she thought, what is happening here? And every hair on her body stood up, and she started really listening. And what the trees were saying to her was, we are suffering at the roots. Well, what do you do with that information as a scientist? She got down on her hands and knees and looked at the roots. And in fact, they were being tamped down to death. They were being crushed by the millions of visitors' feet and by the miles of pavement that was literally strangling the root system of these ancient trees. And the vans, the trolleys that were moving through, and she realized this had become a place of entertainment at the expense of the very trees themselves. And she made a vow to those trees that she would shift things. What she did is she took the science and made a report and said, do we have it in us as management to turn the Mariposa Grove from a place of entertainment to a place of contemplation, to truly make this a sacred grove? The last 5 years, they've engaged in a restoration project. Her proposal was accepted. They've moved all the asphalt out of the Mariposa Grove. The trolleys are gone. Now it will be a contemplative place. People will whisper, not shout. They will walk, not be on motorized vehicles. This was one woman who listened to those trees. And as a scientist, with her gift, made a recommendation that was accepted. This summer, the Mariposa Grove, restored, will be open to the public. Sacred rage.
Wow.
I have goosebumps.
That's beautiful.
It's all about just listening to the signs and what the earth is telling us.
That's why Terry is an inspiration to you, Nicole.
Yes.
And to me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did she set you on a path?
It's wonderful remembering back. It was actually 20 years ago. I was a sophomore in college, and I was trying to decide what major to pursue. And I was making a choice between art history and environmental studies. I was the first class that was able to choose that as a major. And I remember you came to our campus and gave a lecture.
I remember you.
And in the span of that evening, you were able to connect all of the courses I was taking at the time. I remember there was one on indigenous cultures and anthropology, one on geology and the main landscape. And I don't remember the other two, but in the course of your lecture, you connected all of the topics I was covering. And it was a sign I knew I needed to major in environmental studies. And then the next morning, you joined a small group of students for a sunrise hike up the mountain behind our campus.
Wow.
And I was so moved by that experience. And for me, it connected the dots, not just from my own experience with my family, going on trips in national parks, going on annual canoe trips in the Boundary Waters. But more importantly, it also was about how authors like you translate an experience that I could identify with again and again. And I've been on that path ever since. And I'm so thankful to you and your writing. And I know I speak to many people that are in the environmental field that mentors who show you the way really can change your direction. So
And I'm so inspired by your leadership. It goes both ways.
Do you do that often when you speak at a university? The next day you're taking a sunrise hike with the students, or was this kind of unique?
Well, I think Bates is unique and Nicole is unique. Yeah. And do you remember one of your fellow students walked to Bates barefoot?
Yeah, Ryan. Yeah, he would hike the AT every year from Virginia to Maine school. And then when the year finished,
barefoot?
He would hike back.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, and I met his mother. And,
yeah,
you know,
this is really remarkable.
To me, this is community. And this is what we do.
Really
this is intergenerational. And again, it's the joy. You know, insects on a bough, floating down river, still singing. And, you know, I remember Marty Murray, who was one of my mentors, just said, you know, the conservation movement is a group of spirited people. And that, to me, again, is that joy, that love, that passion.
So, Mitch, I don't know if you can top that.
No. Let me just say, but I'm inspired, though.
I am curious about what drew you into the kind of work you do and what sustains you, I guess.
It really is, for me, I am very, ever since I was little, I think I probably drove my mother nuts, and I'm the youngest of eight, so she had already been well-worn yeah. by that time with everybody else. But I am feverishly solutions-driven to pain. So I look at situations and
you act like that's a character flaw.
It is.
It is not.
Talk to my husband. He's like, stop looking. Don't fix. You know, but I was working in sustainability, and anytime I'd meet with an organization, whether it was an airport or a business or a corporation or even in government situations, when they'd talk about sustainability, they'd want to start talking about their recycling first. And they wanted to point out that people in their buildings kept throwing garbage in their recycling bins and recycling in their trash bins. And we'd look at it. And at one point, I remember being at Chicago O'Hare Airport, walking up to a bin thinking, I am that person that's standing at a bin right now that isn't sure what to do, and I care. And this man walked up in front of me and threw in a dirty diaper in the bin I was about to put my newspaper, and he said, it's all going to landfill anyway. And so, and this is where I kind of tie into this confusion thing. Everywhere you go, every label on every recycling bin looks completely different from one bin to the next. Even if it's the same way that you should be recycling from one bin to the next, somebody in every building is having to figure out how to label their bins. So as a result of that, there's millions of different looking labels on bins everywhere. And everybody's passionate about recycling, but they're all confused by recycling.
Right.
And so I started this nonprofit to introduce a standardized labeling system for recycling bins, thinking if we could remove that chaos, maybe we could act on our good behavior. And that's why I think that that's a theme for humans, because even just in the recycling space, we are doing this. And it's dramatically changing. Like Orlando Public Schools started using the standardized labels, and their recycling went up 90% in 1 year.
This is deceptively simple. I know it isn't simple, but it
no, it is. And I think that's what is happening: is we're accepting chaos and complexity as the norm, and we're bumping into each other because of it, and we're pent up with anger and rage because we can't keep it simple enough to actually start acting on things, at least the things that we're in control of.
And we become paralyzed.
And exactly. And analysis paralysis. And so with this particular solution, I think the theme is there. Let's work together to create actionable things that society can start to do to take power back. And when it does come into situations like this where it's so big, the situations are so big with our leadership, we have more power than our leadership with dollars. We are collectively
right.
We have more power than anything. And it would be the greatest fear of a dictator or any government to know that their commerce of their country is dictating changes in leadership and changes in decision, because nobody can touch consumerism if it's organized in a way to affect change. Nobody would want to rattle that, because it is about commerce for the leadership.
It's also about sphere of influence. Every every human being has a sphere of influence, whether it's your school, your church, or place of worship, or workplace, we all have. And if we start there, I think the ripple effects are just
enormous.
Yes.
And I think the one thing I saw in China that surprised me, I mean, there were many things, but what I saw in the people that we met is that they're looking for values beyond consumption, beyond mm-hmm. capitalism, beyond consumerism, because they've taken it to the extreme. Yeah. And they're really saying, what does it mean to be Chinese in the 21st century? Right. What are our values? And you know what is the biggest selling book in China? Walden.
No way.
Who could have ever imagined? It was introduced in 19... It was translated in 1949. It was reintroduced in 1982. It is sacred text.
Wow.
Henry David Thoreau. Yeah. And that's because he talks about economy in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think in America, we've got to face that too. Yes, we're all consumers.
Right.
And there is power in that, in our choices. But what's beyond consumption?
Right.
And what really are our values as Americans? And if we don't figure that out, then everything's for sale.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I close the roundtable with book recommendations, and I'm stealing The Hour of the Land, so as my recommendation. So you three, I'd like a book about, and it doesn't have to be brand new, but a book that you hold close and that you love to share that is meaningful for you in the work and the values that you hold. Mitch, does one come to mind?
Yeah, Originals. By Adam Grant.
Yes. Excellent.
And I think, again, it's not easy to disrupt systems. And so I like the book Originals because it really is kind of encouraging those people to take the risk to do more to solve the big problems.
Nicole, how about you?
I love the book Active Hope by Joanna Macy, which talks a lot about how, as an activist or somebody that's working in the environmental field, can re-nourish and continue to give back. So I think it's really relevant to this conversation.
Terry, how about you?
I'm reading The Book of Joan by Lydia Yuknovich. Mm-hmm. And it's an extremely disruptive and disobedient book. It's post-apocalyptic. It's about the divine feminine. And I cannot read it fast enough. I am loving that. And I also am back rereading Emily Dickinson for her precision of language.
Mm-hmm. Hey, this has been one of my favorite roundtables of the year. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Just a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
Really great to have you here.